Accession number 28642, Reel 12.
The fact that you'd survived, and you were going to talk about some of the survival rates that you mentioned.
Yes, well, of course, at the beginning of the war, it is wrong to accept that you may not survive and stop worrying about it. Obviously, not everybody's going to survive. And I suppose, to a certain extent, you can plan your life to give you a slightly better chance of survival. Well, now, I was appointed to a convoy escort ship. That's what I joined the Navy for, to learn anti-submarine warfare. And that seemed a fairly safe occupation. And while I was in Bluebell, well, she did survive. Then it came a time, after 2 years of that, when I was confronted with an appeal for volunteers for special and hazardous service. Now, the first reaction to that sort of thing is say, no, I'm not looking for trouble. But Admiralty advised commanding officers to draw this notice requiring volunteers to the attention of their officers. And when Bluebell's captain drew my attention to it, I said, yes, or put me down as a volunteer. Now, 3 years went past, 3 years serving in submarines, which was a fairly hazardous operation generally, but I have survived. And looking back, if I had stayed in Bluebell in February 1945, I'd have been torpedoed in the Barents Sea. The ship would have blown up. And of 90 crew, one survived. And my chances of survival would have been a little more than 1%. As it was, I joined submarines. And there were six Australians in submarines. And I just analysed those six because they're all fairly similar, all fairly keen, same sort of training. And they all served in operations. And of that six, three survived. One was lost by enemy action, the other two by accident. And submarines have a lot of accidents because they operate in an alien sort of environment. So my chances of survival in submarines went from 1% in Bluebell to 50% in submarines. Now, if I'd known that, that is such a wonderful opportunity that I wouldn't have hesitated to join submarines. Nevertheless, I am very fortunate to have survived three out of that six. I think it's not all luck. There's a good deal of luck in it, but there's a good deal on how you manage your own vessel. Although two of the three that were lost in Pentland Firth in an accident, and if I'd have been in their submarine, I think the same would have happened to me. As far as we know, they didn't do anything wrong, but the submarine towing them had to round up to try and rescue a man overboard, and the tow went slack, and they would lose control. So the only thing they could do would be to come to the surface, which they did, and collided with the submarine. It was at night in a storm. So in that case, I can't say that if they'd been better submariners, they would have survived. It wouldn't have made any difference. But in other cases, the accident was caused, really. And I think I was a reasonably well accomplished submariner, particularly with an engineering background. And we certainly never, our submarine never let us down because we kept it in good order. So I think the more you know about what you're doing, the more chance you've got of surviving. But on the other hand, if you go to war, you've got to accept it. The war causes casualties.
What sort of education do you think you got out of your experience?
I think the principal education is in management. Because there's a lot of training in the Navy. You learn, first of all, about submarine detection, which is largely an electronics exercise, but also an exercise, I suppose, in teamwork and in strategy. And I think strategy is something you use in civilian life. And the moment you join submarines, you get a lot of technical training in electrics and mechanics and hydraulics and so on. And all that all goes into your fund of knowledge and expertise. There's a lot of hands-on work. Well, in a crew of four, everybody pitches in whatever the job is, whether it's overhauling a valve or cleaning out a bilge. Everybody does it. And hands-on work is good training for everybody. So I learned that, but I think the main skill is in management. When you have command, you are a manager of a team and of a vessel. And I think that is my main aim. In fact, I decided during the war, as it went on, that after the war, I would try and emulate some of the senior officers that I'd served under who I thought were good managers. And all of them were good at their job and they were good at people. They took an interest in people. In fact, my first captain of the submarine flotilla, who's a pretty high and mighty man from my point of view because I was a sub-lieutenant, when I married Mary, he and his wife had us to their quarters because they lived in the submarine depot, the shore depot, had us there for dinner and gave us two silver Soviet rings with Max and Mary engraved on them. And I thought that was a very humane thing for him to do, and his wife. They did take a personal interest in people, and I thought, well, in my job, I'll do the same thing.
How did it change you as a person, do you think, the experience?
Oh, I think it made me very single-minded, probably intolerant, and a bit nasty. Just ask my daughters and my wife. Well, a friend of mine said to me recently in the yacht club that I gave my wife a hard time, and I suppose I do too. It makes you very strict, because when you run a ship, you don't accept second best anywhere. It's got to be top line all the time. And I think you're inclined to apply that to your own family. I don't know whether I'm any worse than some people. I don't think I'm brutal. I never strike anybody. You try to get there with words rather than blows. I'll use some sort of direct language at times. I'm never rude to people, at least I hope not to be rude to people. But I really think I am fairly strict.
When you look at your experience, when you look at the Second World War, we've spoken about the possible achievements, what we got out of the Second World War. How did it make you look at life, do you think, the human condition?
Well, I suppose it's probably made me strive for something like excellence, because you've got to do that to survive. You've got to keep your ship in going order. And I think I do demand a high standard. And this applies to my family too. When my daughters were studying, I think I leant on them fairly firmly about study, which a good many parents do, but not all. But I did. And they both achieved a good deal. They say, in spite of my influence, I think it had an effect. So I think that's been one effect it had on me looking at life. I don't think I'm too hard on my wife. She probably does. She wants new carpets and new curtains in this house, and we'll get them eventually. you do study economy, because that's pretty important. And also, I don't ever go into debt. For my first house, I did. I borrowed from the Commonwealth Government 3.75% for a war service home, and I couldn't pay it back quick enough. In fact, one of my friends, an ex-soldier, he became a lawyer. he came to see me a couple of years after the war, when he had received his allocation of a war service home. And he said, I've had to pay out all my money in this house, a deposit on this house. He said, I'm going to be carried out feet first without ever having paid for it. Well, in fact, he was. As a result of his own success, I paid my house off in about 3 years, I think. He could have done, but he was very successful in the legal profession, and he had to buy his share into one of the leading legal firms in Perth. So he wasn't going to pay back War Service loan at 3.75%. We had to borrow probably 10% of part of his business. And so he did die in that house without having paid for it. His widow had to pay for it. But 3.75% is such a low rate of interest. That was the market, his success. But I didn't have to buy out of a partnership, so I just pay off my debts. And so I don't owe anybody anything, and that's probably a good thing, probably largely a matter of good fortune, because one big advantage of having served in the services was that in my last year at university, I wanted to... I was doing electrical engineering. We had to design a transformer, and I spoke to one of my colleagues who had served in the Navy, who was working for the electricity department of the Perth City Council, and I said, could you arrange for us to visit the transformer shop of the electricity and gas department? So he said, yes, he'd do that. So my year from the university went to have a look at this transformer out of its tank in the shop, and there were a few people there to show us around. I didn't know who they were, but one chap, I should have known, he was wearing a suit and a collar and tie. I asked him a few questions, and he knew all the answers. And the following week, my friend said, Mr. Edmondson wants to see you. He's the general manager. And he was the man I was talking to in the transformer shop. And apparently I'd made an impression on him asking his questions. Also, he read about me in the paper, the fact that I achieved a certain amount of notoriety in the Navy, and I went and saw him, and he offered me a job. And I was only halfway through my final year, wasn't even qualified. Well, that was a wonderful thing, from wondering whether I'd ever be employed, to be offered a job halfway through your final year at university. And 5 years later, he gave me my first promotion from, efficiency engineer at South Metal Power Station to a manager for the whole power production department. And to get that promotion early on was a wonderful thing. And I think my Navy service had contributed to that. I might say that I got a job and promotion at the hands of an ex-serviceman. I didn't get it at the hands of anybody else.
Well, I'm going to ask, you know, what the feeling is like in relation to comradeship, in relation to these chaps that you served with.
Yes. Well, the comradeship of service is second to none. The people you served with, even in different services, you do anything for them.
How do you explain this to someone who's never served, who's never been in the Army or Navy?
Well, I don't suppose you can, but if you've had a common experience with somebody, whether it's at sea or in the air or even down a mine, you probably have a great comradeship with people you work with. I think I've got a good comradeship with people now in the power generation industry. But I've had promotion at the hands of an ex-serviceman, but not for a non-serviceman, you also find when you're discharged that there's a bit of competition between the ex-serviceman and the non-serviceman. The non-serviceman is probably worried that these people are going to come back from the war and receive all kinds of benefits, and they'll be in competition with the civilian. That wasn't very noticeable, but it was there all the same. And I found it in a couple of cases where I applied for other promotion and didn't get it. And I felt then there's probably a bit of favouritism for the non-servicemen. But I can't complain about it, because I had a fairly good run. And I spent most of my life from 1956 until I retired in 78 in the third layer of management in the State Electricity Commission. And that's not bad. To get to the top management, you've got to be a politician. and I'm no politician. So I probably got to my level of achievement.
Yeah. When you look back at your experience, when you look back at the 6 hours that we have of your interview, and you think 100 years in the future, when a chap or young lady comes and listens to your tape,
yes,
doesn't know you, you don't know them,
no,
what would you hope that they would get from listening to this interview?
Well, I could quote an example there. I was prevailed upon to write a book, and I did say to one pretty well-known author, a chap called Frank, I can't remember the name now, I'll think of it in a minute, Frank Walker, he's in Budgie War in New South Wales. He said, look, supposing the dumbest sailor in Nelson's Victory wrote his impressions of the Battle of Trafalgar, it would be illiterate, it would be bad grammar, the spelling would be bad, but it would be wonderful reading today. Anybody would get it and absolutely devour it, because the man at the time talking about what was going on then. So he said, that's what you'll be like in a couple hundred years' time, because it's 200 years this year from Trafalgar. So I would think that that would be one point of interest. That is, this is something historic, terribly historic. But also, they might find that nothing much has changed. That there was a threat at the time of Trafalgar, there was a threat 60 years ago in World War II, in 100 years' time, there'll still be threat. And humankind won't have solved all these problems, and probably people get some guidance from seeing what happened 100 years ago. They came out of it then, or we can come out of it now. So I think that we, technically they won't gain much, but I think so far as humankind and human nature is concerned, they'll find that people are just as difficult then as they were way back.
Max, unless you've got something else to say, I'd like to thank you very much for...
No, I think that's about all I've got to say.
Thank you very much for all your help and time.
Well, I hope it's useful.
Definitely. Thank you.